So, I would like to spend our time this morning on the topic, as I put it on your sheet, of the image of God, how to forgive. But I want to focus on two questions which inform how we forgive as we approach Yom Kippur. The first, the Torah describes human beings as being created famously in God's image. So I want to know what that means. That'll be our first point. And then second, how does that affect the way we deal with each other before Yom Kippur and all year round? There's something about this the idea of being created in Tzelem Elohim that actually has great ramifications for this time of year and beyond. So I brought you an interesting source to start with. So a fellow by the name of David Clines. David Clines is a British biblical scholar. And he writes, "Humankind is the one godlike creature in all the created order." Right? When you look at Bereshit, when you look at the creation of the animals and the birds and the fish and so on, we're the only ones who are listed as in any way or described in any way as being associated with God. Its nature is not understood if it is viewed merely as the most highly developed of the animals with whom it shares the earth. Right? If you just say human being is the most advanced form of animal, you haven't comprehended what it means to be godlike. Nor is it perceived if it is seen as an infinitesimal being dwarfed by the enormous magnitude of the universe. If you look at us as really small in the face of the big universe, again, so then what's godlike about us at all? By the concept of the image of God, Genesis affirms the dignity and worth of humanity and elevates all humans, not just kings or nobles, to the highest status conceivable short of complete divinization. Which I didn't think was a word, but my spell check didn't call me on it, so I don't know. His meaning is clear. He didn't want to say divination because that means something else, so he ended up with divinization. But his point is that by saying that we are created in the image of God, it demonstrates, it confirms, or affirms as he puts it, the dignity and worth of humanity. And it elevates us to the highest status conceivable, short of being God. What he hasn't done is to explain what that image of God actually is. What is this status that we've been given? In what way is it higher than all the other creatures? What does it actually mean? So, I brought you some sources here that we could use. But before we see the sources that I brought, what does it mean to you? When the Torah says we are created B'Tselem Elohim, which we keep translating as in the image of God, and that's pretty much the standard translation that people give, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's not the physical image to me. It's not the physical image.
Right. How do you know that?
God has no image.
Right, so here we have a problem of, we have the problem of scholastic history here, which is we approach a biblical text through the eyes of the Rambam, even though the Rambam wasn't around when the text was written. Meaning, we grew up with Yigdal, Ein Lo Dmut Haguf, God doesn't have a body. We grew up with the idea that, of course, God doesn't have a body. The Rambam makes the point that God does not have a body because philosophically it's inconceivable. Because as the Greeks taught, once there is a physical form, that means it will deteriorate at some point. Right? It also means that it is divisible. Everything physical can be broken down into smaller parts. Right? When I was in school, they taught us, well, there are atoms that can't be broken down. But of course, we learned that's not true. Right? As you get older, you learn more about that. But the Rambam's point, saying that God does not have a body, was not universally held in Judaism. There were those who were not impressed by the philosophical argument. Rabbi Avram ben David comments on the Rambam when the Rambam says that it's heresy to believe that God has a physical form. Ravid says, you know, greater people than you thought that God does have a physical form. So there. And there are biblical verses that seem to support it, that the Rambam then has to reread as metaphor and so on. I'm not disagreeing with you, nor am I disagreeing with the Rambam. My point is only that we jump to, well, Tselem Elohim can't mean physical form, because we've been so indoctrinated to believe that there's no such thing as a physical form associated with God.
The word Tselem also doesn't really mean the exact form. The word Tselem sort of gives you a feeling of some kind of reflection of something.
Like what Tselem is not the actual picture of?
Well, Tselem is used to refer to a form of something. Yeah. When we use it today for a photograph and a camera is a matzlama, we're creating an image that looks like, the original matzlama created a physical image. It's only the digital matzlama that isn't really creating an image at all. It's just
right, but it's not the actual item, the image of the...
Right. No, but it's something that when you look at it, you will see the sign that looks like the original. Fern or Diane, someone here.
No, I was commenting. You said the image of God not having physical wasn't also part of it as a response to Christianity, where they view Jesus as a God, he has a physical form.
So it doesn't, right? So our allergy to the idea of a physical form to God does not seem to come from the problem of Christianity. Given that I would have expected, if so, to find the Gemara itself weigh in and say God has no physical form, because they're dealing with the early Christians. I would have expected the Gaonim, perhaps, they're really dealing in a more of a Muslim world, so maybe they didn't feel the pressure to. But the Rambam certainly doesn't have Christian pressure on him.
But image and form are two different things. An image is still something that we perceive, it's not something that we can touch.
I'm not so sure. I think that's because of the English word that we use as opposed to the Hebrew. I think Tselem really is something tangible. Mm-hmm. So Rashi thinks Tselem is indeed something physical. Rashi's solution is to instead retranslate the invisible word between Tselem and Elohim. Meaning, you're missing a word there. In Hebrew, that's fine. Tselem Elohim. In English, we add the word of. Right? You're missing a piece. You can't say image God. It's image of God. So Rashi says, of is a funny word. He's not speaking English at all. Rashi is speaking Old French. But he notes that Tselem Elohim doesn't have to mean God's image. Image that is God, so to speak. Rather, it's the image designed by God. If you take a look at number 2, I gave you the pasuk with a translation where I translated it based on what Rashi says. Vayomer Elohim, and God said, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuseinu, let us, I'm not discussing the us there, that's its own discussion, but let us make man in the tzalem and dmut, image and form, we have designed. The image that we have designed, not the image of me, not the image of God, as in it looks like God, but the image designed by God. And God created man in his image, meaning the image that God had designed.
So how does that differ from every other creation? God had designed what a cow will look like.
Precisely the problem. Right? That's the problem. Is so in that case, we're no different. And the answer would have to be that what Rashi is reading here is the fact that the Torah actually stresses this was an image selected by God means there must be something unique about it. And the text doesn't say what it is, but there's something unique and special about that human image. That's one approach. Malbim gives what I think of as one of the more famous approaches. It must predate him. But I brought you Malbim because I found it and I thought, this is a very nice, concise way to put it. Yesh lo koach ha-bechira va-choshiyut. He says, a human being has the power of free choice. We have freedom. Shaydei zenivra b'tzelem Elohim, such that we are created in the tzelem Elohim, and he quotes the verse, Naseh Adam b'tzalmenu, let us make man in our image. And he says, v'chein yeser kochos nafsho shemit alim al kochos nefesh yeser balei chayim. And so the other powers of his spirit that are higher than those of other creatures. So whatever we have in our spirit that is higher than what animals have, that's Tselem Elohim. In whatever way human beings have some level of superiority, starting with free will and continuing to other attributes. But it's a spiritual attribute.
What about the mention Yad Chazakah, Zro Netuyah, and we
right, so that's what I said. Right,
to listen, to hear us, so.
Right. So that's right. So that's what I said. The Rambam explains as being allegory. He says it clearly doesn't mean a hand. No one saw a hand. It means force, as we express in terms of hands, because that's the way we speak. That's the way the Rambam deals with it. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in his Nefesh HaChaim offers another approach. He says, yeah.
I'm kind of want to know why is it sometimes in the plural.
Right, so I don't want to go into a huge length, but basically the word Elohim is itself plural. The word Elohim, which is the name of God that's used there, Vayomer Elohim, is a plural word. It means possessor of all of the powers. The Elohim is the one who has every possible strength. The word Kael, which is at the base of Elohim, means power. Elohim, the God with all of the powers. So it's really a plural word. So by definition, same way that Mayim is a plural word and there's no singular, that's why we look at Elohim. And so it's not saying that there's more than one God. It's simply saying all the powers. That's one way to look at it.
The name that starts with a tzaddik, also in a plural.
Yeah, well, all the names of God, the meaning Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, is also a plural name. They are our masters, literally. Some will read it as simply the royal we. As opposed to what I'm saying about all the different powers, it's just the royal we. And then you have the classic Medrash that says that God speaks to the angels and doesn't need to consult them, but he does so in order to teach us some humility. There are all sorts of different explanations for why. The Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in number 4 says that it's about power. The power that God gave us, that's Tzelem Elohim. He says, V'hu kimilas Tzelem u'dmus kan eino kemashma'o. He says, don't get hung up on the words Tzelem and Dmud. It's not what it sounds like. Kikasuv meforash u'ma d'mus tarachulo. He doesn't tell you the Rambam as his basis for saying God doesn't have an image. He says, the Pasuk says, what image could you compare to God? Which he takes to mean God doesn't have an image. Right? In the same way that when the Torah says, you didn't see any image at Har Sinai, therefore don't make images of God, so that's cited as a source to show God doesn't have an image. Right? That's another verse that's popularly quoted. Ela perusho dimyon ma be'eze davar. But it means some comparison to God. There's some similarity of some kind. And what is it? So he says, Shem Elohim, just like I was just saying to you, Violet. He says, Shem Elohim, yadua perushoshu moreshu yisbarach shemo bala kochos kulam. He says, we know. Elohim means the one who possesses all powers. Kmo be'ez b'riyas ha'olamos, kulam b'ra'am v'imtziam hu yisbarach yesh me'ayin. Like when God created all the worlds, he created all of them something from nothing. Bara hu yisbarach es ha'adam, he created humanity. V'ishli to'al ribe rivavan kochos v'olamos ein mispar. And he gave us power over all of these different forces and realms. Our actions influence and affect the whole universe. That's the power that's been given to us. Okay. So that's another idea. But the one that I wanted to get to is from Rav Moshe Cordovero. Rav Moshe Cordovero, just a little bit of background, was a student of Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, author of the Shulchan Aruch, in Tzfat in the 16th century. Rabbi Yosef Karo is best known as the author of the Kesef Mishnah commentary to the Rambam, the Beis Yosef commentary to the Tur, and the Shulchan Aruch, which are all serious halachic works. But there's another side to Rabbi Yosef Karo. He was also a very serious mystic, a very serious Kabbalist. That's not unique to him. Meaning many of the greatest halachic authorities we had were also mystics. Ramban, Nachmanides did it in the 13th century. It is even argued that the Rambam had a mystical side. It's a very interesting debate as to whether there's mysticism in the Rambam. There certainly is philosophy, whether there was mysticism. But the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, was also a mystic. And Rabbi Cordovero, in his Pardes Rimonim, mystical work, attributes his understanding of the Sfirot, how God influences the universe, to Rabbi Yosef Karo. and quotes from a work called Magid Mei Sharim, which is attributed to Rav Yosef Karo, which is a heavily mystical work with its own backstory. So Rav Moshe Cordovero was the youngest of four to receive smicha from the Ma'ariv Beirav. You may be familiar with the fact that smicha today is not what it once was. Smicha traditionally, going back to Moshe, was supposed to be teacher to student directly in person. Moshe puts his hands on Yehoshua, that's smicha, to put your hands on. And it was supposed to be done, a teacher to student, and it conferred a certain level of authority within Jewish law. It wasn't simply that, it was certification that says, okay, you studied the books and you know what you're doing, but it actually conveyed certain powers. It was a judicial position, really, such that, if you think of, like, you have a bench, right? You have where the judges sit, and you only can create a new judge if there's a seat available for the judge. There's no such thing as a judge without a spot on the bench. There's no judge at large. That's the way smicha used to be. So there were no rabbis at large. There was a position in a certain community to be able to give halachic rulings. There was a need to fill that position, so then they would give somebody smicha. That stops in the Roman times. The Romans put a halt to smicha by killing everybody, basically. The Romans created an edict saying that if you give somebody smicha, we find out about it, and remember, it's done in a beis din. So there are people around to hear and to be able to talk. So they said, we will execute whoever gave the smicha, we will execute whoever received the smicha, and we will execute the Jewish population of the nearest town. And that puts an end to smicha as it was. What we end up with instead is just certification, saying, okay, you studied the course of study, you did proper training, okay, we believe you can now give halachic rulings. It doesn't carry the powers that it once did. There was an attempt, though, in the 16th century to resurrect smicha. The Rambam writes that it could be, you could make the argument that if all the sages in Israel, I forget if he says all or most, would get together and agree on somebody to receive smicha, Mashiach would come. Then that would actually be effective. That would be the way to restart smicha. And on that basis, the Ma'ariv Beirav, one of the leading rabbis of the 16th century, conferred smicha on four people. Rabbi Yosef Karo was one, Rabbi Moshe Detrani was another, Rabbi Moshe Galanti was a third, and Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was the youngest of the four. It did not endure because there was a big dispute between the rabbis of Tveria and the rabbis of Yerushalayim. It didn't work out. But he was the teacher of the Ari and of Rav Chaim Vital, who became the lead student of the Ari. He died months after the Ari arrived in Tzfat in 1570. The Ari claims that the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero, was pure of sin, and he died only because of the fact that once Adam and Chava ate from the fruit, all human beings had to be mortal. But otherwise he wouldn't have died. He wrote the Ornei Rav, the Pardes Rimonim, the Tomer Devorah, and what we're going to be doing is we're going to be learning Tomer Devorah here. This is what we're drawing on. So take a look at source number 5. He says, Ikar Hatselem v'hadamus ha'elyon hein pe'ulosav. He says, you want to know what Selem and Demut of God are? They are God's deeds, His actions. In other words, Tselem Elokim means the actions of God, the attributes that God brings into the actions that He performs. It is when human beings are created, Tselem Elokim, it means that we are created not to look like God in terms of our physical form, but to look like God in terms of our behavior. That's the idea. If you look at source number 6, I quoted you the pasuk, V'halachta bidrachav. We are supposed to walk in God's ways. There's a Gemara in Shabbos in source number 7, when the Torah says, the Jews say at the sea, Zek heli ve'anvehu, this is my God, and I will glorify Him. So the Gemara says, Havei domelo, that means you have to resemble God. Mahu chanun v'rachum, afata haye chanun v'rachum. God is gracious and merciful, that's what you have to be also. That's what Rav Moshe Cordovero believes is what it means to be in the image of God. However, he doesn't take it as a description of man. He takes it as an imperative for man. This is a command to be B'Tselem Elohim. It's not just that you have potential, but it's actually an obligation. And take a look at source number 8. Do I quote you from the Talmud Devarim? There is a translation out into English, by the way. I think it's Feldheim. That may be worth reading for those who are interested in the Sefer. But Rav Moshe Cordovero writes the following. Ha'adam ra'ui she'yisdameh lekono. It would be fitting, or it is fitting, for a person to resemble his creator. Note that it says Ha'adam, Rav Yitzchak Cohen, my Rebbe from many years ago in MTA, notes it says Ha'adam. Meaning? No. It means every human being. Jew and non-Jew alike. Every human being is created to be ra'oi. He is suited. She is dame lekono. To resemble his creator. In other words, it's in everyone's potential. And then that person will carry that higher form. Tselem udemut, the tselem, the demut, she'ilu yidume begufa velo bepi'ulot. And I heard a shiur from Rav Moshe Weinberger, who is the source for quite a bit of what I'm going to say here. I don't remember how much anymore, because I heard the shiur years ago. But I remember that I was very influenced by it at the time that I was learning this. He says, she'ilu yidume begufa velo bepi'ulot. He says, if a person were to resemble God in his form, in his body, meaning, if we were to have all the potentials that are supposed to be built into us to resemble God, but our actions would not do so, then you're making your form into a lie. Your form broadcasts to the world that you're capable of being godlike, but you're not. And they will say of him, looks beautiful, but his deeds are ugly. Because the essential, and this is what I quoted in number 5 above, the essence of the higher tselem and demut are in his actions. What good is it for you to be like this higher form, demus tavnis evarav, to have the form of God's limbs, so to speak? But your actions don't resemble God. He says, this imposes upon us a great expectation that you're going to live up to having Tselem Elohim. So with this idea, we've answered the first question, first of all, of what does it mean to be in God's image? It means to have the potential to emulate God. But what I want to do with this is to apply it to the idea of forgiveness and to suggest that forgiveness is not about the other person. It's a common conception that I should forgive someone who has done something to me because it's the right thing to do to them. And that's not, that's not a wrong idea. The Shulchan Aruch talks about not being cruel to others by refusing to forgive. So it's not as though that's wrong. But forgiveness is also about being our best selves. It's also about being our best selves. It's about being God-like. I should forgive because God forgives, right? Yonah, as an example, right? There are many examples in Tanakh, but Yonah, is in the air right now. But that's the idea, is that forgiveness is part of being God-like. Yes?
So if we are emulating or mimicking attributes of God, then we can be angry, we can be jealous.
Right. So I was going to point this out before. The Gemara that talks about Bahalakta, that talks about Zakili van Vehu and so on, only speaks about emulating what we think of as the nice side. I believe that's because the others are a lot harder to apply. Or I should say to apply properly. It's easy to be angry.
Yeah, where do you draw the line?
But I think that's the idea is that when you're dealing with the nice ones, being generous and gracious and giving and merciful and forgiving and so on, so let's say I get it wrong, what's the big deal? If you're going to, on the other hand, insist that you're now the judge, right, and you get that wrong, now you have real trouble.
Yeah.
So we stick to the ones that we can safely emulate. The truth is, one can go wrong by being generous and giving and so on inappropriately. I could squander the resources I have been given to give to people properly and use them improperly. It's not that there's no penalty or no price to getting it wrong, but I think that the downside is a lot smaller on that side than it is on the other. Yeah.
Can you define forgiving? I don't understand it on a personal level.
Yes. Forgiving to me, and we're going to see some of it here as part of the discussion, is to view it as though what the person did to you never happened.
Oh my gosh, what about forgive yourself?
Forgiving yourself is also important. Blazer Papo in his Pele Yoetz talks about chesed, and he says the most important chesed, the most important kindness, is the one that you exercise with yourself. One does need to do that. The trick when you're dealing with yourself as opposed to others is that you're also responsible for yourself. In other words, I can forgive somebody else. If somebody speaks Lashon Hara about me, if somebody does something bad to me, I can forgive them and hope that they're going to get their act together at some point. But if I'm going to forgive myself for speaking Lashon Hara, who's going to call me to task? Who's going to make me improve? So I'm playing both sides when I'm dealing with myself.
You're unconscious, your own.
But once you forgave, it's gone. It's like it never happened. Now what happens? Now who's going to be responsible? That's the trick. It's a lot harder when you're dealing with yourself.
You try not to do that again.
Sort of start with a clean slate and start again. It's like if you're new.
Yeah, but you have to correct what you've done wrong. Otherwise, you're just going to do it again.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You start again, and that you're not going to do.
Right.
That's gone. That was in the past, and now you're not going to do it again.
Right. There's also another problem with forgiving yourself, and that is really forgiveness is the property of the victim. You know, if I do something wrong, it is true that I have, in a way, harmed myself, lowered myself, certainly, trained myself to do bad things, certainly, brought myself in for punishment, potentially. So there is an element of, I hurt myself and I can forgive that. But I can't forgive myself on behalf of the people I hurt. So that's another key distinction.
You can forgive yourself, but you also have to ask forgiveness from the person
Yes.
who hurt.
Yep. Okay. All true. Okay, so what does it mean to learn forgiveness from God? What am I talking about in practice? So I brought you here in source number 9 a text which is likely familiar. These are 3 psukim from the end of the book of Micha, which is one of the Triasar, the collection of 12 small books of Nevi'im. Those will be in the Bayit this Yom Kippur. I will be giving a shiur during the break between Musaf and Mincha for a few hours. We'll be talking about, it'll be a few hours at my minyan, shorter from other minyanim. But we'll be going through the themes of each of the 12 of Triasar. So it won't be recorded. In the Molesky Base Matters, yes. where my minion is. My minion. It will not be recorded.
Yeah.
It's where the colon usually is.
Yeah. Somewhere.
Opposite the office.
Is that more safe?
Yeah, there's space. There's plenty of space.
Half the people are sleeping.
Yes, that's also true. This is also true. Not half.
No, I'm exaggerating.
Some of the people are sleeping. This is good. This is a part of the service that is the psukim here from Micha appear in our liturgy twice. Tashlich is one, because they are the source for the practice of Tashlich in its most basic form, when the Pasuk says, you shall cast into the depths of the seas all of their sins, right? We ask God to throw our sins into the sea. It's not about us throwing anything into the water. Please do not throw anything into the water. It is about God throwing the sins into the water. And then the other, correct, is after we read Yonah as the Haftorah at Mincha on Yom Kippur, we end with these 3 psukim. So the psukim go as follows, source number 9. Mi keo kamocha, who is powerful like you, God? Nosei avon, ve'over al pesha, lish eris nachalaso, you pardon avon, I translate it here as iniquity, just because I needed different words for sin. Ve'over al pesha, you overlook, I'm going to have to retranslate overlook as we go along, but we'll go with it for now. Overlook transgression, lish'eris nachlaso, for the remnant of his heritage, lo hechazik la'ad apo, he does not maintain his wrath forever, ki chafetz chesed, who he desires kindness. Yashuv Yenachamenu Yichbosh Avonoseinu. He will once again show us mercy. He will suppress our avon, our iniquity. V'tashlich v'mitzlozyam kochatosam. You, God, will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. He goes from third person, right, to second person. He is talking about God before. Now he addresses God directly. You will cast their sins into the depths of the sea. Titan emes liyakov chesed l'Avraham, shenishbat l'avosenu mibekedem. Grant truth to Jacob, kindness to Avraham, as you swore to our forefathers in days of old. There's a lot to say about these psukim, but we're not teaching these psukim right now. I give a shir on Micha years ago, and you can find it on YU Torah, and there you'll find a discussion about why, for example, Yitzchak is skipped. But I bring these here because in Tomer Devorah, Rav Moshe Cordovero uses these attributes, these psukim, as the basis for 13 attributes of divine mercy. Instead of the classic source, which is Moshe, right, after the Egel, after the golden calf, instead he uses these psukim. So Rabbi Weinberger says that it's because the Zohar in Parshas Naso and in Parshas Emor says that the 13 attributes we recite, the ones that come from Moshe after the Egel, those are the lower set of divine mercy. The Rahmana Elyon, the higher mercy, is what's seen here in these verses. How do you know that? What's your indication of that? So I wrote something here, and I don't know if this came from Rabbi Weinberg or if this was my own idea. But the difference between the two is that Moshe's version comes after the golden calf. It's a time of atoning for the golden calf just to keep us alive. That's what God teaches Moshe with those 13 attributes of mercy. Micha, on the other hand, is actually describing the period of Geula, of redemption, the time of Mashiach, when he describes this. So this is about redemption. It's not the lower level of God, don't kill them. It's the higher level of God, bring them redemption. You're getting more with these. So Ramosha Cordovero uses these to describe how Hashem's mercy works and how his forgiveness works. And what we're going to do is go through the first three of the 13 using his analysis. Clear? So these psukim are the basis for the 13 as he reads it. We're going to see the first three, which are first, Mikael Kamocha, who is a God like you, is his first of the 13. Nosei Avon, the fact that God, I translated here as pardons iniquity, but as we're going to see, it's more than just to pardon. And then the third one that we'll get to is Over al Pesha. The Over al Pesha, which also we translate here as overlooks transgressions, but there's more to say about that as well. Okay. Our first one is Mikael Kamocha. Who is God like you? Or who is powerful like you?
What is this Kael?
So Kael is Aleph Lamed in the original, but Aleph Lamed, Kael, is God. Okay. I translated it here as powerful because it can be read as just the word meaning powerful, in which case it's not a name of God at all, but it could also be read as the name of God, and that's why I did it with the Kuf. So Rav Moshe Cordovero writes the following, and here I just throw you an excerpt out of the paragraphs that he has on this. Me'olam lo chata adam negdo, shelo yehyeh hu ba'oso harega mamash, shofeach shefa kiyumo utnuas evarav. He says, no one ever sinned against God without God simultaneously giving him the energy that he uses in order to be able to move into sin. Right? If we believe, as Judaism teaches, that everything that exists is created and supported in an ongoing way by God, then when a person does something wrong, when the thief is slipping something out of somebody's pocket, when someone is speaking Lashon Hara, whatever it is that you envision as somebody's Avera, at the moment they're doing it, where do they get the energy from? They're getting it from God.
What happened to free will?
What do you mean? They're still making the decision.
It's not stopping it.
The point is only that they're drawing on resources. You know, it's the kid who is sent off to school with the parent's credit card, right? And uses the credit card for all the things they told him don't do it.
Well, right? God puts a sin in front of us, and we choose.
We make a choice.
Yeah.
How are you going to resolve free will overall in divine knowledge and predestination? It's totally not this class. They maybe that should be 3 hours on Yom Kippur afternoon. Let everybody fall asleep. But the image that's the image here is that when the person does something wrong, they are drawing on divine credit to do so. And even though the person is sinning with that strength, God doesn't keep it from him. God endures this shame, this humiliation, effectively, of being misused in this way. And Rabbi Weinberger, when he discussed this, caught on the word sovel. What does the word sovel remind you of in Hebrew? Savlanut, right? Patience. And what is a sabal?
A porter,
exactly. Someone who carries stuff, right? There's another word, sevel, which is suffering. But it's more than just patience. It's to carry. I translated here as to endure. That was the best that I could do in terms of a good English word for it. But but what he's describing here is for God to be so veiled, to endure what we are doing. And if you take a look at source number 11, Ramban gives us a definition of divine love that uses this word as well. He's commenting on a pasuk that speaks about Hashem being choshek us, loving our ancestors. So he says, Hanivchar le'ohev, the best kind of beloved, hu hayadua lisbol es ohavo b'chol haba alav mimenu, is somebody who is known to endure, there's the word, lisbol, to endure the one that he loves, with everything that happens from him, no matter what that person does. V'Yisrael re'uyim lekach mikol amen, we are more suited for this than any nation. K'mo she'amru, as the Gemara says, shlosha azim heim, there are three creatures who are identified as az, meaning strong but also bold. Yisrael ba'umos, and it's the Jews among the nations. And now he explains what it is about this that makes us worthy of God being sovel us. Ki yamdu lo benisyonos, because we stand up to all the tests. O Yehudai, O Tzaluv. He quotes you a Medrash in Shmos Rabbah that the Jew says, either I will be a Jew or I will be crucified. But I'm not willing to give in on being a Jew. So he says, if the Jew is willing to be that devoted to God, then the Jew is worthy that God should be so veil us, that God should say, I'm never going to reject you.
So on Rosh Hashanah, the prayer of the Tokev,
Unasana Tokev?
Right.
Yeah.
So that he was basically kind of crucified.
Oh, in that story.
Yeah.
And he was murdered.
Well,
in the classic story, right, which isn't
it's not the same.
It's actually no. I mean, it's a great story, and in and of itself, it likely happened more than once in Jewish history.
Yes.
But as the origin for Nisana Tokef, it's likely not true. Rav J.J. Schachter did a lot of research on this years ago. It could be, but it's difficult because Unasana Tokef exists in manuscript form centuries before the time when Rav Amnon of Magenta was supposed to have lived. Now, that doesn't mean it could be. He knew it from the manuscripts, and he came back and taught it, and so on.
It's like someone found a dream or something.
Yeah, so if you go on...
historian is going to talk about.
You never used a burned-out mop? Look at the bottom of the page for an assignment token. Yeah. Okay. When you're a kid and you use the Burma mobster and you're looking for something to read as they're dragging out your assignment token, you read that story. But if you go on Wayuta and you search for Amnon of Mainz or of Magensa, or if you look under Rabbi J.J. Chachter Shiram, you'll catch there the work that he did on this story.
That the Christians picked up on this idea of like God suffering and sort of attributed it to Jesus, like Jesus is carrying our sins kind of thing.
I don't know. I mean, they grew on Yeshaya. They didn't need this, you know.
Okay.
I mean, you do have. I didn't bring it here, but you have the pasuk Ania Sisi Vania Sani Es Bol Va'amaleit, right? That's God saying, "I will be so veiled." So you do have the psukim that use the word soveil in reference to God. So you do have that. Yeah.
Some of our soveil is in suffer.
Sorry?
Soveil. We have it right here.
Suffer.
Yeah. No, but as a pasuk to trace it to that. The Maharsha, in source number 12, also talks about this Gemara that speaks about the Jews as being bold. And he says, what does it mean for us to be bold? When the text talks about the Jews being bold, lav hainu givura, it doesn't refer to strength. But it means that we stand firm at our word and we do not recant for anybody. So that is the idea that the Jew is firm in the love for God, and God will be firm in that love for us. And that's what love is about. It's to be so veil of the other person. I've brought you an example of it, the Gemara in Bava Metzia in source number 13, which is not directly relevant, but I think it makes an important point for us. Ohev lifrok v'sone litzon. The Torah talks about the mitzvah of prika uti'ina, which is the mitzvah that if you see somebody else's animal struggling under the burden, you're supposed to help unload it. Or if the guy's having trouble loading the animal, you're supposed to help him load the animal. But in one case, it talks about if you see your friend. In the other case, it talks about if you see your enemy. And either way, you're supposed to help. So the Gemara asks, so what if I could help my friend unburden his animal? Or I can help my enemy load his animal? Which one should I choose? So he says, mitzvah b'sonei. The mitzvah is to help the enemy. Why? K'dei l'chof es yitzro. To control yourself. To force yourself to help the person who you didn't want to help. Yeah. Yeah, to learn that kind of conduct. So Rav Moshe Cordovero takes this idea and extrapolates it from Mikael Kamocha, from that opening set of words. Because Mikael Kamocha says, who is God like you, but who is powerful like you, in the sense that you, God, are providing the strength. You're providing the ale, so to speak. You're providing the power with which the person sins. You have the ability to cut them off at any time, and you are so veil. You don't do it. And applying that for us, in terms of our forgiving, is the idea of resembling God, being in the image of God, and forgiving as a function of being so veil in a relationship with somebody else. Now, I have to stress here, it's very, very important to note, that this isn't talking about in an abusive situation. That doesn't mean that people have to suffer the abuse of others and say, well, I'm being so veil, so I'm just going to live with it and tolerate it and all that. It doesn't work that way. The difference between us and God is that for all God is so veil, God is never going to get hurt. Whatever it is that somebody's doing, whatever terrible deed somebody does, God is never going. He may suffer for it in the sense that it's this elbone, it's this shame of he's supporting us and we're still sinning. But fundamentally, you're never going to take anything away from God. God is not going to die. God isn't going to feel any sort of physical harm. A person who is suffering from others has to protect themselves. That's number one. Number two, you have to be smart in how you're so veiled. Right? When it comes to parenting, it's a very tricky balance because children need discipline. But this is from Rabbi Weinberger. He says, a parent has to be careful. The parent should never refuse to be so veiled. The child has to know that the parent will continue to be so veiled, that the parent will never disengage from the child. That's the, I think, a very important lesson in this. Okay, so that's Mikael Kamocha. We learn from God that just as God does not disengage, but God continues to endure and to support the person who is sinning, that's our duty when we forgive. Number two, nosei avon. So nosei avon, I translated in number nine as who pardons iniquity. But what does it mean to be nosei?
Carry.
So what does it mean in the context of carrying sin? What does that, how does that work? So I think the way that the commentators usually take it, Ruth, you were going to say?
Remembers?
Nope. And not to take it on himself either, because that would be that would just put us right into the Christian camp. But rather, it's, I think the way Rashi does it on the Pasuk is to say what it means is to, you envision one of the old style balances, you know, one of the old style scales. So the sin was going to weigh it down, and God is no say, he lifts it up so that it won't way down the other side.
For what reason?
In order to be able to keep us going, that we shouldn't be weighed down by the sin. But there's an idea here which is based on a mission in Pirkei Avos. The mission in Pirkei Avos in the fourth parak says that every time one sins, he creates a kategor. A kategor, as Rashi there explains, as the Rambam there explains, and this is clearly pshat, it fits the Greek that the kategor is coming from, is that it's an agent who will testify against the sinner. A prosecutor. That's the literal read of what a kategor is. Every time a person sins, whatever they did in this world generates something that will be brought to bear against them when they have to stand trial one day for what they've done. But Ramosha Cordovero adds a dimension to it. He says, kategor doesn't just mean this prosecuting angel. It means a destructive force. Take a look at number 14. Lo yasa ha'adam avon, shelo yivra mashchis. I think the way to read it is, a person never sins without creating a destructive force. And they quote our Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that I just mentioned. However, avira achas kana lo kategor echad. You perform a transgression, you acquire a prosecutor for yourself. And he says, look, very oso kategor omi lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu va'omer ploni asani. Right? That prosecutor stands in front of God and says, so-and-so created me. Right? When they did whatever it was, they made me.
Created.
Yeah. Vein bria miskayemes ba'olam ela b'shiv oshel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But wait a minute, he says. Nothing can exist in this world without divine support. So what supports this destructive force as it stands before God? Logically, God should say, I'm not going to support any destructive beings. You go to the guy who made you. Let him support you. Take your energy from him. And the destructive force would come kill the person. He would take his energy, so to speak. He would drain him to support himself. But God doesn't do that. There's the word again, sovel. God actually bears, he carries, and endures this avera. Just like he supports the entire world, so he supports this destructive force. The idea here is that God is supporting, like we already said, he's supporting the person when the person sins, but even more so now, he is supporting the continued existence of the person who has sinned, and not saying, look, you sinned, you have to deal with it yourself. God is going to support him as well. It reminds me very much the story, which I may have told at some point here over the years, that I heard from Rabbi Yisachar Franz from Baltimore. You know, every year, my shul in Pennsylvania, we used to play the Tisha B'Av videos from the Chafetz Chaim Foundation. I never watched them, but there was one year, I don't remember why, I decided to watch it, and I learned this great story from our friend. He was talking about the issue of making shalom, of making peace. And he said, I'm not sure if I should give the idea first or the story first. I'll give the story first. The story was that a fellow came to him and told him that he orders the newspaper every morning. And every morning he, you know, brings it in bright and early and nice and crisp, and he has his morning coffee while he's reading the newspaper. I assume he goes to Minyan first, I hope. But one day he brings in the newspaper and he can immediately see it's not folded right. Something is off. And then the next day, again, something's not quite right. It's not creased the way it's supposed to be creased. And so the third day, he gets up early, and he watches out his window, and he sees the paper boy drop off the paper, and then he sees the neighbor come over, take the paper, and sure enough, it's gone for like 20 minutes, and then the neighbor, you know, brings it back and puts it on his doorstep. So he's steaming. And he comes to my friend, and he says, "What do I do?" What do you think Ray Fran's advice was?
Invite him for coffee. Read it together.
Ray Fran's advice was buy him a subscription to the paper. Do not try this at home. This takes the right combination of neighbors, I think. But he says, buy him a subscription to the paper. Because if you're going to give him a hard time about it, every time you step out your door and he steps out his door, you're both going to be looking at each other and thinking about this. When there are issues about the lawn or the kids left a toy or the dog or whatever it is, there's going to be such bitterness between you. You're much better off just getting him a subscription to the paper. And he said, call it Shalom, buy his money. That's what he said. He said, every person in their budget should have a certain amount of money that is allocated for shalom. You have bought peace.
$600 a year.
You should read it online. You can print it out and fold it yourself if you like. This is going to vary based on the people involved. You could end up offending him more by buying him a subscription. So be careful. Be careful about how you implement it. But I happen to love it because I think that it's very good advice for a whole host of situations having nothing to do with newspapers. Be willing to spend on shalom. It is the best investment you're ever going to make. There you go. So, but in terms of this, I think of the person buying the other person the paper as the nosei avon. You are essentially supporting him in it, and it's better for you to do that. You're better off that way than saying to him, you support your own avera, so to speak. So that's the second one. And then third, and this is very strong, he picks up on the language, go back to number 9 again, where it said, ve'over al pesha. So I translated over al pesha as that God overlooks transgression. He passes it by. Right? Which I thought was a reasonable translation. However, Rabbi Cordovero takes over like ma'avir. What is laha'avir? To remove it. To move it away. Laha'avir. To move it away. You could also do laha'avir as to pass by something. But I'm using laha'avir as when you remove something, and that's going to fit with the psukim that Rabbi Cordovero brings in this discussion. He says, over al pesha means that God cleans up the sin himself. As opposed to waiting for you to clean up your mess, God will make things right in the world and not demand of you that you make things right. We're still supposed to, right? As part of the tshuva process, we have to repair what we've done wrong. But fundamentally, even if you don't, God will repair that which was done wrong. Take a look at number 15. Ein hamachila al yedei shaliach el al yado mama shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God does not send a proxy to take care of this forgiveness. God does it himself. V'hainu ve'over al pesha, and that's what it means when it says he forgives sin, or he is over al pesha, he overlooks transgression, as I translated before. Sholeach meimei rechitza ve'over v'rochetz ha'pesha. He sends the cleansing water, so to speak, and forgives and washes away the sin. V'hinei mamash kidmus zet tzarech lios ha'adam. That's what a person has to be like. Not to say when somebody sinned against you, well, I should fix it. I should be the one to just forgive him, let him right the wrong, and then we'll have a conversation. He says, when a person sins, God himself, not via an agent, he is over al pesha, he does it directly, fixes that which the person corrupted and washes away the filth of that person's sin. So if somebody does something to you, lower the barrier for that person's tshuva. As Rabbi Cordovero continues to say, beyond the piece that I excerpted here, it will help the person not to sin again. Because when that person sees that you reached out to them, right, that you went that far to help them, even though they had done something against you, hopefully they will be moved by it. Now, I should note, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, writes, if somebody hurt you in a way that cannot be repaired, right, the Lashon Hara is the classic example, you don't have an obligation then to forgive them. There are cases. I don't want to get too far into that example because it's not a great example to bring for a variety of reasons. The bottom line is that there are times when withholding forgiveness for a period of time is appropriate.
Thank you.
I said there are times. I didn't say all times. There are times when. But to me, what Rabbi Cordovero was trying to say here is that this is also part of emulating God. When we say, and this will sum up what we've said, when we say that we are created b'tzelem Elokim, meaning with the ability to emulate what God does, what that means here, we've only seen 3 out of the 13. I highly recommend seeing more of Tomer Devora. But first, the idea that we endure even if that person used the support we were giving them. Even in such a case, we have to be willing to bear it and to live with it. It means supporting this person even as they are sinning against you and not turning to them and saying, well, you're on your own, you do it yourself. And I recognize that the first and second sound very similar, and I think there is a lot of overlap between them. And then third, being willing to go the step of cleaning up the sinner's mess ourselves and proactively coming after them to forgive them. Those steps are the steps that are necessary because it is ra'uy for us to emulate God, to look like God with the power of being B'Tzelem Elokim. There's much more to say, but we'll stop here. I wish everybody a Gemar Chasima Tova for a year of health and of Simcha and of Shalom and Bracha, and God willing, we will resume Shmuel on October 11th. Thank you very much.